Today is Thursday, June 3rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden aims for 70% COVID vaccinations of adult Americans. Plus, the African Union suspends Mali after coup.
The African Union is calling for, quote, an unimpeded, transparent and swift return to the civilian-led transition.
Also, the ILO projects a grim post-COVID jobs forecast for developing economies. Our top story today is in the U.S. President Joe Biden is launching a month-long nationwide push to get 70% of American adults vaccinated by Independence Day on July 4th. But the administration has not yet outlined its vaccine-sharing strategy with the rest of the world. White House correspondent Patsy Widaskuwara has this report.
With 170 million people vaccinated, life in the U.S. is starting to feel more normal. The country is going even further with a month-long nationwide push to get 70% of adults vaccinated by Independence Day.
If you get a shot this week, you can be fully vaccinated by July 4th, and you can celebrate Independence Day free from fear or worry.
On Wednesday, President Joe Biden announced initiatives including free childcare for parents getting their shot, free rides to vaccination sites, recruiting barbershops and beauty shops to help with outreach, and encouraging companies to provide vaccination incentives.
Free beer for everyone 21 years or over to celebrate the independence from the virus.
As Americans are getting free perks for their free shots, a study by the Duke Global Health Innovation Center shows the U.S. is on track to have hundreds of millions of excess vaccine doses by July.
We have committed to 600 million doses in this country. 366 million have been distributed. We should look to see if we're going to have excess capacity over the next few months. The 80 million, mostly AstraZeneca, that has been committed globally, we need to make sure that gets out quickly, gets out equitably.
The administration is facing mounting pressure to announce when and how it will share excess doses.
We'll focus on equity, the equitable distribution of vaccines. We'll focus on science. We'll work in coordination with COVAX.
COVAX is the United Nations mechanism to ensure lower and middle-income countries have access to vaccines.
The COVAX AMC can help put us on another path in which we defeat this virus together.
On Wednesday, a virtual summit hosted by Japan and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, secured an additional $2.4 billion funding for COVAX, bringing the total to nearly $9.6 billion. The U.S. participated but did not announce additional contributions.
The United States has contributed $2 billion to Gavi for COVAX, and we have pledged an additional $2 billion through 2022.
The administration is also considering sending doses to individual countries. Many have requested, including South Korea, Bangladesh, and Vietnam. The White House has not announced its response. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has called on Central American leaders to tackle corruption, poverty, and drug trafficking to improve the lives of their citizens and stem migration to the United States. Blinken made the appeal in Costa Rica, where he met with the regional leaders, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken praised his hosts in Costa Rica for their strong commitment to democratic values, but indicated good governance would also be crucial to tackle the root causes of migration to the U.S. from the poverty and violence-stricken Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Tensions have flared between the Biden administration and the Northern Triangle countries after Congress released a State Department list last week identifying 16 current and former senior officials from these countries as allegedly involved in drug trafficking or corruption. In March, Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez's brother was sentenced to life in prison in New York for extensive drug trafficking. after a trial that also implicated the president himself. Relations took another hit when El Salvador President Nayib Bukele fired the country's attorney general and Supreme Court magistrates. These developments, experts say, make it difficult for the Biden administration to administer the $4 billion in aid it has pledged to the region.
The Biden administration is rightly committed to addressing these structural problems in these countries that cause people to leave their villages and their homes and to flee to the United States. But to do so, it finds itself forced to work with governments that are not committed to the same values: transparency, fighting corruption, human rights, having transparent and effective democratic institutions. And so they're constantly having to recalibrate and balance how you engage in these countries.
In the face of food insecurity, exacerbated by two major hurricanes in the region last year, some experts say the Biden administration needs to think even bigger and broader than the usual foreign aid package.
And that's why I focus on trying to wrap the Caribbean basin into some of President Biden's bigger domestic initiatives. So he's talking about spending gobs of money on infrastructure development, roads, ports, airports, et cetera, in the United States. Why not think of the Caribbean basin as our near abroad?
Blinken's visit paves the way for Vice President Kamala Harris' upcoming trip to the region, where she is tasked by President Joe Biden with addressing the root causes of migration. Last week, Harris invited business leaders to the White House to push for private sector investment in Central America.
We have MasterCard, who intends to partner across sectors to bring 5 million people in the region into the digital economy and to support 1 million small businesses. I'm excited to report that Microsoft will work with local partners to expand broadband access for up to 3 million people in the region in the next year. I'm pleased to report that Nespresso will expand coffee sourcing activities in Guatemala and start in Honduras and El Salvador, supporting local communities.
Harris plans to visit Guatemala and Mexico next week on her first trip abroad as vice president. Migration from Central America is a thorny political issue for the administration, with Republicans faulting the president and vice president for failing to end what they call a crisis at the U.S. southern border. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
As the United States is roughly near the midway point of its withdrawal from Afghanistan, a question that remains is if neighboring Pakistan will host U.S. forces to enable them provide, quote, over-the-horizon, unquote, support to Kabul. In the past, Pakistan has rejected the notion. Dr. Asfandi Amir is an expert on terrorism in Afghanistan and Pakistan at the University of California at Berkeley. He tells VOA Afghan service reporter Ahmadullah Achawal that a hosting agreement isn't entirely outside the realm of possibility.
This is a very complicated issue for Pakistan. And my sense is that Pakistani policymakers, specifically senior army generals, they're going to weigh this proposition very carefully. On the one hand, they will be concerned about the potential of any backlash, domestic political backlash. They will also worry about how groups like the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan might use basing for purposes of recruitment and propaganda. But on the other hand, Pakistani policymakers will also consider the potential gains of this type of basing. So what we know is that Pakistan's economy is not doing well. Pakistan is also under the threat of sanctions. Pakistan is also worried about India's growing alignment with the United States. Any military basing which anchors U.S.-Pakistan strategic relationship for a period of time, it's possible that Pakistani policymakers see that as a gain worth having. And let's not forget the history of U.S.-Pakistan basing relationship. In the 60s, the U.S. had a base in Pakistan, you know, near Peshawar called Padabeer. Then in the 1980s, the U.S. had multiple bases in Pakistan for the war in Afghanistan to support the Mujahideen. And then even in the 1990s, U.S. and Pakistan worked on a secret basing arrangement or secret covert action arrangement to kill Osama bin Laden, which was thwarted by the 1999 military coup of General Musharraf. And finally, post 9/11, U.S. had multiple bases in Pakistan from which it waged the war on terrorism. So there's ample history of this type of basing. And for now, I would not rule it out within the realm of possibility. But clearly, there will be major downsides of this decision.
So we will talk about its consequences, Pakistan and for the region. But the question is, if Pakistan provides access to the U.S. or provides bases to the U.S., how effective would be these bases in reining in terrorists, not only in Afghanistan, but also in the region?
So we have to look at how U.S. has waged some of these campaigns in places like Yemen, Somalia, and in northwest Syria over the last decade or so. There, the United States government has not tried to destroy the entire terrorist organization that it is worried about. Instead, it has only killed the top leadership of the terror group that they are worried about and people who are engaged in plotting against Europe and the United States. So I expect that any basing in Pakistan will be used to, one, monitor the threat of any transnational jihadist activity inside Afghanistan. Most likely, it will be Al-Qaeda. And beyond that, the U.S. government will seek to monitor plotting activity that might take place, a flow of funds, flows of any Western foreign fighters especially. And so against such limited target set, it's possible that this type of campaigning can be successful. We see in Syria, the organization of Al-Qaeda there, Khurasuddin, it has been badly damaged by U.S. targeting over the last 3 to 4 years. Even in Yemen, we see that some people in Al-Qaeda who were involved in plotting against the United States, they have been set back. Their operations have been largely curtailed by U.S. counterterrorism pressure. So it's possible that in this case, any future threat that might emerge can be brought below a certain level. But we have to consider the reality that the Afghan Taliban will be, you know, can potentially be the state in Afghanistan, and the Afghan Taliban can be potentially supportive to some of these organizations, which means that some of these groups might have better means to both hide and to recover in case of losses.
Thus, UC Berkeley, Asfandia Mayor, speaking to the VOA Afghan Services, Ahmadullah Achawal. Israel may have a new government after 2 years and four elections. A new government coalition effectively ends Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 12 years in office. Reporter Ricky Rosen gave International Edition Steve Miller the details from Jerusalem.
Yair Lapid, the head of the Yesh Atid party, who was granted the opportunity to form a government by the president, called the president Rivlin, who was in the middle of a National Cup soccer game, to inform him that 35 minutes before the midnight deadline, he had succeeded in forming a government of eight parties, ranging from hardline far left to far right, and including an Israeli Arab party for the first time in Israeli history. And it's a party of strange bedfellows, because on many, many issues, they have admitted that they will never be in agreement, but they're hoping that they will be able to somehow bridge the divide in Israeli society that have been exacerbated by 12 years of a very divisive Netanyahu government.
This government formed with just 35 minutes to spare, and if it hadn't done so, there was a potential for a fifth election. Why did it take so long to come together just before that midnight deadline?
Everyone was trying until the very last minute to get the best deal for their party. The last conflicts to be resolved were between the hardline right-wing party Yamina, the party of the upcoming Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, and the leftist Labour Party over who would sit committee which chooses judges. A very significant committee, a little like the role the Republicans in the U.S. Congress played in pushing through conservative federal and Supreme Court judges. And they finally decided, after a few days of negotiating, that they would have a rotating place on this committee. And the other last-minute concessions involved the Islamic Arab Party, which was able to get $16 billion in benefits for the Arab sector, something which had never been officially included in a government platform before.
So what's next? Because the government is set to be sworn in sometime within the next 10 days. And I guess also, what's next in store for current Prime Minister, who's on his way out, Benjamin Netanyahu?
When you say that the new government should be sworn in between 7 and 10 days from now, That is a best case scenario because the government is based on the very slimmest majority possible, 61 votes out of 120. So it can be easily brought down by any defector. And Benjamin Netanyahu has pledged to try to get any one member of any of the conflicting parties to defect from this coalition. And he may have a chance to be able to do this before the government is sworn in next week.
That's reporter Ricky Rosen speaking with my colleague Steve Miller from Jerusalem. The African Union has suspended Mali. In a statement this week, the regional body warned of further sanctions and demanded a restoration of civilian rule after last week's military takeover. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
The African Union has suspended Mali's membership in response to last week's military coup and is threatening sanctions if a civilian-led government isn't restored. The military arrested interim President Baten Dor and Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouane last week and pressured them to resign, derailing a transition to democratic elections. That was after another military coup last August ousted the previous administration. Former Vice President Assimi Goïta, a colonel who led the August coup and last week's revolt, was declared president on Friday. The African Union is calling for, quote, an unimpeded, transparent and swift return to the civilian-led transition, failing which it wouldn't hesitate to impose targeted sanctions. Mali's neighbors and international powers fear the latest revolt will dash promises to hold a presidential election in February and undermine a regional fight against Islamist militants, some of which are based in Mali's desert north. The African Union suspended Mali after last August coup, but reinstated the country a few weeks later after the heads of the new civilian-led transitional government were announced.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Three Uyghurs who fled from China to Turkey have described forced abortions and torture by Chinese authorities in the Xinjiang region. They spoke to the Associated Press ahead of giving testimony to a People's Tribunal in London, which opens on Friday. The tribunal is investigating whether Beijing's actions against ethnic Uyghurs amount to genocide. The foreign minister of Cyprus says three European Union countries and three Middle Eastern nations are exploring the possibility of training personnel in border, customs and cybersecurity techniques at a U.S.-funded facility expected to be ready to use early next year. A dissident journalist arrested when Belarus diverted his flight says in a video from prison that an unidentified associate set him up. The footage of Roman Patasevich was part of a TV program aired late Wednesday by the state-controlled ONT channel. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. An analysis of post-COVID-19 employment prospects forecasts global unemployment will reach 205 million in 2022, surpassing the pre-crisis level of 187 million in 2019. The International Labour Organization has launched its new edition of the World Employment and Social Outlook Trends 2021. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
ILO Director General Guy Ryder says the employment situation in low-income countries is expected to be worse than in high-income countries. He says wealthier countries that have better access to vaccines and strong fiscal support are expected to recover faster from the crisis.
For many millions of people, the working hour losses, combined with a lack or absence of social protection, have simply meant an increase in poverty. And here again, with a comparison to 2019, an estimated 31 million working people are now classified as extremely poor, living on less than the international poverty line of $1.90 per day.
He says 5 years of progress in reducing working poverty have been wiped out by the coronavirus pandemic. The report finds the worst affected regions in the first half of 2021 have been Latin America and the Caribbean and Europe and Central Asia. It says global employment is expected to get better in the second half of this year, provided the pandemic does not worsen. Among the biggest losers are women. Ryder warns the crisis threatens to undermine and even reverse progress on gender equality.
Women have been more likely than men to lose work, and at the same time saw their unpaid hours of work, care work in particular, increase. And so, without specific action, this will bring back outmoded gender divisions and roles.
The ILO says many young people also have been badly affected by the pandemic. Globally, it notes youth employment fell 8.7% in 2020, compared with 3.7% for adults. It says that disruption in their ability to get work experience could have a long-lasting effect on both wages and employment prospects. Authors of the report warn, without a recovery strategy that specifically targets those groups hardest hit by the pandemic, the inequities that exist in the world will continue to worsen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australian scientists are leading an international consortium that is building one of the world's most powerful ground-based telescopes. It promises to see further and clearer than the Hubble Space Telescope and unlock mysteries of the early universe. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The telescope is called MAVIS, or Multi-Conjugate Adaptive Optics Assisted Visible Imager and Spectrograph. It's a long name for a highly complex instrument that will be the first of its kind. It aims to remove blurring from conventional telescope images caused by turbulence in Earth's atmosphere, which is why the stars appear to twinkle in the night sky. Scientists in Australia say the new technology will allow them to peer back into the early universe and help them explore how the first stars formed 13 billion years ago, as well as monitoring changes in the weather on planets and moons in our solar system. Images produced by MAVIS will be 3 times sharper than the Hubble Space Telescope that was launched into Earth's low orbit in 1990 and remains in operation. Associate Professor Richard McDermid, a scientist based at Sydney's Macquarie University, says the new telescope will change the way we explore space.
The clarity gives us 2 things. It helps us see a sharper image, but it also helps us gain in sensitivity so we can see fainter things and we can see them more clearly. That allows us to push into a new frontier of the furthest and faintest things we can see. So, for example, the first stars in formation inside the first galaxies, because when we look far away in astronomy, we're also looking far back in time because it takes time for the light to reach us. And so, yeah, we're really building on the legacy of Hubble, but we are going to go deeper and even sharper.
The ground-based telescope will be installed at a facility in Chile, run by the European Southern Observatory, a research organisation based in Germany. It will take 7 years to build at a cost of $44 million. The MAVIS consortium is led by the Australian National University and involves Macquarie University, Italy's National Institute for Astrophysics, and France's Laboratoire d'Astrophysique. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Lawmakers from Britain's governing Conservative Party say they hope to force a vote in Parliament that could make the government reverse a contentious cut to UK's foreign aid budget. The government has dropped a long-standing commitment to spend 0.7% of the country's gross domestic product on international aid, citing the coronavirus pandemic's blow to the economy. International organizations say the reduction will hurt programs that help some of the world's poorest people. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Gene Adolfo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.